Today, Dr. Kashi unravels the psychology behind harmful relationships with screens, sex, substances, and snacks. He explains how suppression begets deprivation, which fuels obsession. The solution lies in function. Roll the intro! Hello! Hello! And welcome to Coffee with Kashi. I'm your host, Dr. Trevor Kashi. One more break, promise. Today is about sex, drugs, and snacks. Sex, drugs, and snacks. So food in the context of sex, food in the context of drugs, and food in the context of other taboo subjects that by virtue of their taboo increases their restriction. Now, for the sake of clarity, taboo in short means forbidding association with, which is why taboo things are typically considered topics of extreme discretion, like sex and drugs typically are. They're either spoken about behind closed doors or people avoid discussion of them entirely, okay? Now, this taboo increases restriction, which if you're following I can't stand it, then you know this restriction ends up revving up a person's oh shit machine, call it. So this also like higher sympathetic nervous system tonus, et cetera, okay? In effect, your space between stimulus and response starts to shrink when you become impulsive and wound up. This space between you becoming stimulated and responding to that stimulus shrinks. And the chances of you doing something dumb are higher, and the chances of you doing something smart are lower. Okay, that's essentially what happens when you rev up somebody's oh shit machine, okay? The space between stimulus and response shrinks. The urgency in that person builds by virtue of their impulsivity, the distance between stimulus and response. That gets cashed in, that urgency gets cashed in for as a behavioral response are, and this is colloquially referred to as blowing out, okay? You restrict long enough, you go, I can't stand it, and then you blow out, do something dumb. Okay, this is in the context of blowing out, where a person overindulges in the thing that is restricted, typically. Okay, these things are most easily recognizable, blowing out, having a bunch of booze, maybe violent outbursts holding in and finally slugging that person. Okay, sex, obvious, drugs, binge eating, etc. All generally speaking, taboo subjects that people consistently restrict and blow out on. Okay, the SRO cycle. Okay, the stimulus response outcome cycle for this what's called restriction disinhibition patterning for fancy science term people out there can be represented as restrict, blowout, and punish. Restrict, blowout, and punish means I'm gonna hold it in until I can't stand it, and then I'm gonna really go ham. Hard as a mofo, as the kids these days say. And then you do that and you feel really bad and dumb about it because you broke your own rules, your demands of yourself, you blow out, and then you punish yourself. You call yourself a turd burglar, you treat yourself real nasty and all sorts of crappy things, which then prompts you to say, well, now I have to restrict myself even more when the restriction to begin with is what was causing the blowout. So hopefully you understand how the SRO cycle relates to restriction blowouts and punishment in the context of restriction disinhibition patterning. How blowing out actually leads you or anybody to restrict yourself even more, which then leads to blowouts, okay? Causing more frustrating stimuli to emerge. Again, this podcast is meant to serve as a more widely applicable source of insight in how you may be categorizing and operating in the context of food such that it may have greater power over your decision-making capacity than you'd like it to have. In other words, you feel certain ways have urges around food. Food stimulates you, right? Food stimulates you, has you thinking certain things. Those things you're thinking have you feel certain stuff, and those feelings make you urge to do something silly. You build an urge. So if you tell yourself to STFU and think about that, around certain foods, you may have urges that you may want to cash in for a stupid behavioral response. Hopefully this is starting to make a little more sense now. This is relatively beefy. Again, we're already a few minutes in, so thinking caps on. Let's cover drugs first. Ooh, drugs, okay? This is a post made by Sarah R., one of the private members who was a TKN challenger. So she is now a full-time private client, and she made a wonderful post a couple weeks ago that we pocketed and using as an example now. So she said she got really excited about this Biscoff cookie butter because the nutrients in it were actually better for other delicious desserty items that she had, especially in the context of peanut butter. So the calorie density for her, for this Biscoff cookie butter, and the ratios that she wanted the nutrients to be in were different. But there's a catch. She said there's a catch. They don't tell you on the label that this shit is crack. That's the part that gets underlined and bolded, okay? Like you have a small amount and your senses go wild and all you want is more and more and more. Consider this a PSA and avoid it at all costs. Look at these associations. It's quite interesting. You see these sorts of equivalencies made all the time in the context of food and drugs. And if you go down the thread, if you're a private client, you can find that thread, but I'll discuss it here. Is that, okay, first, Dr. Kashi has this PSA, sugary fat paste is delicious. This is my surprised face. So this is about the context of the thread and how serious it is taken. Because yeah, that stuff is delicious. You go down the thread and you see, that stuff is delicious. It's dangerous. Keep it away from me. It's totally crack. Yeah, it is like totally crack. All you want is more, more, more. Look at these associations here. It's interesting to see how and when people draw a line between food and eating and purposeful intent to gratify a sensory desire. Sometimes that line is so fuzzy, it may as well be gone in the context of people only eat in the context to gratify sensory desires, or gratifying sensory desire is the purpose of eating when they are two separate things. And relaying drugs and food and sex together blur that line, because in most contexts, those things strictly serve as sensory gratification tools. And using food that way can lead to other strange impulsive behaviors because of the stimulus response, outcome, taboo, restriction, disinhibition, et cetera, okay? Doing drugs to get high, going to massage parlors, shoplifting, food just happens to be a socially acceptable and legal way to debauch. And the only person doing it can really know they're doing it because of the social acceptability of eating for obvious reasons. But it's all the same stuff. It's all the same stuff. Even drawing these comparisons is probably enough to make people cringe. And maybe that's all the more reason to make them. Hence the taboonesses, the tabooness. Even in the context of this thread and in a lot of conversations, consumable food items are readily equated. There are equivalencies made to recreational and dangerous drugs because of the intent that the person has when consuming the food, which is pure sensory gratification, the purpose of a recreational drug, okay? Generally speaking, being honest and genuine about food and eating versus exclusive use of a tool for sensory gratification, in this case drugs, will help you get the best of both, knowing that you are consuming a food specifically for sensory gratification, and here you are consuming a food to nourish yourself. Nourishing yourself can lead to sensory gratification as well. It is smart for that to happen. I dare say there is a conditional should, otherwise the human race would have died out long ago if eating was crappy. Eating is crappy to do, but separating out whether you are consuming something to nourish yourself or consuming something for sensory desire, and separating those things ahead of time will allow you to keep a straighter head when in the presence of these food items, okay? Trying to replace one with the other, trying to replace food and eating and exclusive sensory gratification or confusing them gets weird. That's where guilt, shame, impulsivity, and other negative things start happening. Hopefully that makes sense. Being a crack addict is almost ubiquitously considered bad. And thus, making a food item crack will probably, even if by accident, increase the likelihood of an impulsive, habit-forming consumption of that food item. It's just food! Unless you make it something else. Like by making false equivalencies and then reinforcing those false equivalencies when you are stressed and frustrated, where you learn a little bit faster, okay? It's okay to use food in this way. Just be real about it and okay with it and make sure those times are separated. This is how you can get the best of both. Okay, this will help keep it regulated. Okay, so let's move on to sex. This came in the context of a previous video where Dr. Kashi made a video in the I Can't Stand It series, which is essentially hiding from things long enough, avoiding things long enough, and they solve themselves, right, obviously. A book on frustration and the strange and interesting influence it has on our lives. Okay, there were tons of comments, right, about how people readily hide food from themselves, ban foods from the house, chastise other people from bringing those so-called trigger food, whatever you want to call them, whatever the flavor du jour is for the terminology now, because when they're around those foods, they have strong urges, okay? Indeed, this is a similar connection, you know, that people make with food and addictive drugs like crack, like we just discussed. Alternative and additional language used to describe this phenomenon is also in the context of sex, right? So in a very real sense, people lust for food. They lust for food. And the commentary around lusting for food garners quite a bit of laughter because there's so many comments about hiding it and losing control and et cetera, et cetera. I'm like, man, how has hiding the food from yourself really helped to moderate your lust for confections, right? Which sounds ridiculous when you say it that way. Mostly because it is ridiculous. However, you take a very small step back and you see these connections to food and sex and drugs, specifically lust, are made, these false equivalencies are made and represent, you know, dangerous things effectively in a lot of instances. Think of it this way: food porn, mouthgasms, guilty pleasures, etc. Hell, people even have relationships with food. Relationships which they supposedly regret cheating on. Really? Given the above ideations, lusting is an apparently acceptable feeling to have toward food and eating. It's even encouraged overtly. So it's easy to laugh at this stuff because it sounds silly when it's written that way, because it is. It is ridiculous. It is insane. It is insane to make these false equivalencies, okay? And to be clear, lusting for food is okay. It's okay to want food for the sole purpose of sensory gratification. Drawing that line, making sure you STFU before you do that so you understand the stimulus you're thinking, you're feeling, and you're urging in the context of drawing that line so you know that your urge to do this thing for this reason will help you to moderate those two things, to use food to nourish yourself versus using food exclusively for sensory gratification. Food can do both. The problem is when lusting for food or treating it like a drug, specifically for sensory gratification, is confused with the conditional need for food so that you can sustain your body. Food can do both, and it is okay and encouraged if food does do both, both gratify sensory desires and nourish your body. It's a problem when somebody confuses them or blurs the line. Hopefully that makes sense. It's just as easy to have childish swings like, well, fine, then food is fuel, or if it tastes good, it's bad for you, or if you can't pronounce it, then don't eat it, and other sophomoric axioms. Does this mean if you have a doctoral degree in biochemistry and you can pronounce everything, that everything is good for you? Or that if you're a baby and you're too dumb to read, everything is bad for you? Dumb babies. Okay? This is, again, sophomoric and obviously falls flat. Food is supposed to be gratifying to the senses. Nourishing yourself is gratifying. That is good. But is gratifying yourself nourishing? No, it's a one-way street. Sometimes it happens backwards accidentally. Nourishing yourself is gratifying, but is gratifying yourself nourishing? Negative, okay? Keep these things in mind. If the intent of eating is to nourish yourself, the gratification will come on its own. If you're seeking gratification for the sake of gratification, you miss out on the nourishment part. Hopefully that makes sense and it sticks. Seeking gratification from food instead of nourishing yourself with it is what causes the distorted cognitive behavioral disconnect. It's what causes food to be so insanely stimulating, becoming a frustrated stimulus, so that your thinking, feeling, and your urging ends up winding up that oh shit machine, and your space between stimulus and response shrinks so much, you gotta cash in that urgency. You become so impulsive, you do something dumb, and then you punish yourself for the outcome, which then just leads to more restriction. Hopefully that makes sense. I'm gonna repeat that over and over, because if it is confusing, tell me and I can help explain it more and better. This is my lot in life, okay? Now, this is doubly true when the gratification is in the form of negative reinforcement. That means if you eat when you feel bad to feel better, you reinforce the use of food as a drug or a sex object or whatever, okay? When you eat when you feel bad to distract yourself from it, or you eat to procrastinate, or you eat when you're bored or whatever, that's where these strange patterns emerge and you start blurring that line between sensory gratification and nourishing yourself. The sole purpose of gratification, rather than being gratified, okay, it's a side effect of nourishing yourself. Like I said, gratification comes from nourishment. But if you overlook the nourishment part and go right to gratification, then the nourishment part gets lost. Hopefully that makes sense. Hopefully, please tell me if it's confusing. So yes, it's 100% reasonable to enjoy food you eat and sustain your body. That is the point of food. The most satisfying meals are when a person is truly hungry and truly thirsty, and the enjoyment of that food is divorced from the style of cuisine. In other words, if plain, dry, crappy food sounds delicious, then it's probably a good decision to eat. Try this on for size, okay? People hem and haw over what they eat rather than if it's a good decision to eat. If you're wondering if I should eat, or if, should's a strong word, if it is better if I eat, well then what you eat ends up being so far down the line, it's just that food sounds good. Food. But if you're confused about what sort of food to eat, then you're eating for almost the sole purpose of sensory gratification, and that's the confusing part, okay? In terms of cognitive behavioral confusion and dissonance. So oversimplified here, if you're hemming and hawing over what to eat, then you're choosing between foods which will give you the greatest level of sensory gratification. To that end, it is likely that your hunger is more a trained impulse for sensory gratification, an urge to do something because it feels good, also known as a craving, okay? Again, this is okay. Cravings are okay. Even indulging in cravings is okay. It is just a matter of telling yourself to STFU to determine the stimulus in your thinking and feeling and urging around these cravings so that you know that you are exclusively scratching an itch rather than nourishing yourself, and you can help moderate your behavior in that context. Problems arise, again, when a person has a distorted desire that deviates from nourishment, builds urgency, and have impulsive urges for sensory gratification. Funny enough, impulsive urges for sensory gratification is considered a medical condition for almost any behavior or substance. However, food just happens to be a socially acceptable way to debauch while also being a conditional requirement for survival, which is why it's so strange to talk about. So you see how easy and perverse this can be in the context of a taboo? Well, I need to eat, right? It's so easy to work yourself up in the context of the emotions you use when you use food like drugs and sex, etc., for pure sensory gratification, and also confuse it with nourishment. It makes the conversations hard to have because it's different from drinking or drugs where you're just like, all right, I'm going to stop cold. Like, what do you stop eating cold turkey? Huh? Smart, right? This is why it's irritating and strange and difficult to talk about. People use this social acceptability that it is okay to eat and okay to binge and okay to overindulge in food. It is socially acceptable. And the conditional requirement for health that you need food in order to be healthy as reasons to give themselves defensible permission to use food as a tool of exclusive sensory gratification. This tragically strengthens the impulsive desire for sensory gratification because you're able to reinforce the behavior by indulging in a craving every time you have a stimulus. That is the point. If you are stimulated and you have an aversion or an impulse, an urge to scratch that itch, and you respond by scratching that itch, you reinforce the behavior, create destructive outcomes, which then causes the stimuli to show up again and again. And you end up repeating and reinforcing this behavior over and over. Every time you pass the bowl and grab a piece of candy, every time they see the bag and they snag a bite, get a handful, anytime they see something in the break room, anytime there's a sale at the store, every time there's a meeting or they pass the sign on the way home, all opportunities to reinforce that sort of distortion, that blurred line between nourishment and gratification. Remember, nourishment leads to gratification as well, I would say it should. Okay? But does gratification lead to nourishment? No. All these things are choices. Grabbing out of the bowl, passing the sign, seeing it in the break room, somebody offering it to you, even over and over, even strongly. They're still all choices, every single one. Sometimes they're harder to make, sometimes they're easier to make, but that depends on your level of frustration tolerance. And that gets discussed in depth in Dr. Cash's book, I Can't Stand It, okay? So when a person reinforces their cravings enough, which is easy to do, see above, as it were, that if a craving comes, it often produces an urge so strong it may as well be a food and eating emergency, where they must need it. They need it, or else. Or else I'll starve, and it's not fair, and I can't stand it, etc., and so on. Banning alcohol fails. Banning sex fails. Banning drugs fails. Why would banning snacks work? LOL. STFU with that stuff. Humans throughout history tend to create black markets and strange justifications for banned and taboo things they have trained themselves to overindulge in. This prohibition, this restriction, comes with a lovely addition of ugly, strange, or violent behavior, or all three, if they've gone too long without it. Because they've convinced themselves they need it, or else. Hell, there's even a term, hangry. Hangry, built-in permission to be an a-hole when you've gone too long without sensory gratification through food. How obscene is that to make a joke out of? Understanding that it is in your power to choose what to and if to eat is a big deal. They are two separate and very important things. The if, way more important than the what. You can choose to only keep certain staple foods in the house. That is okay. That is encouraged. Nourishing yourself becomes easier, simpler, more effective, and you become more gratified, but for different reasons, and that's okay. However, banning food because you have given it power over your ability to choose, that's where things get strange, especially because you're the one with the brain that has decision-making neurons. And that thing is a lump of oxidizable carbon, probably made from corn parts. Sensical. Banning foods, although it does have a short-term practical advantage in the beginning, only reinforces that the snack has some magical power over your ability to make and act on decisions. This is why it's best that you STFU to really think about the stimulus that's driving your thinking, feeling, and urging, and audit whether the situation really makes sense and if it's really helping you instead of hiding from it or hiding it from yourself, like having it hidden from you. You can approach this rationally and constructively and deliberately so that you can have a deliberate response. You can approach the response rationally, have a deliberate response, okay? A deliberate and calculated and purpose-filled response to snag yourself a constructive outcome. So you can throw out that old BS right out the damn window, okay? The more you avoid this food, the more you reinforce the food has magical power over you and that you must avoid it or else. Or else you'll take that distorted BS and give yourself permission. You give yourself permission to lose control or go crazy on it or eat the whole sleeve or empty the bag or put yourself into a food coma or whatever stupid crap people say to give themselves permission to do something foolish. All this over probably what is a corn-based niblet with food coloring. This is an absurdity of encyclopedic proportions. Instead of cowering in fear over the possibility of saying yes to that thing, how about saying yes to yourself instead? How about them apples? Thank you so much for learning. This is beefy, but it's so important. And it is very important. Thank you so much for learning. Stay rational. Until next time, Dr. Cashy is out. So that is the official end of the podcast. The winner of Dr. Cashy's awful advice contest is Danielle Crystal. Dr. Cashy had a bout of can't stand it yesterday and wanted some horrible, terrible, awful advice to help him with his bout of can't stand it. And Danielle Crystal gave the most horrible, terrible, awful advice in the history of planet Earth. She said, follow your heart. This is probably the most terrible, awful, horrible advice ever in the history of advice. And she said, I guess it depends on the context, but once I witnessed a colleague say this to a client struggling with substance abuse, telling a drug addict to follow their heart. You know what a drug addict's heart wants? More drugs. Yes, she is right that it is a horrible, terrible, awful piece of advice to give. And it reminds her of somebody making a decision purely based on emotions. Okay? So she is right. She is right. Following your heart means doing what feels best. And this is why it relates so well to the material right now, which is why I'm going over it in tandem. Okay? Following your heart is doing what feels best. Going with your gut is doing what feels safest. Most of the time during times of stress, that is the same thing. Doing what feels best and doing what feels safest are the same when you're stressed out. Doing what feels best is often a pretty awful idea. Often, like going with your gut, it is in conflict with the best thing to do. Living a good life is different than doing what feels good. Going with your heart or gut, they're both pretty awful ideas if you default to that as advice during times of disturbance like Dr. Cashy was yesterday, okay? Thank you so much for learning. I love you. Stay rational, for Pete's sake. Until next time. Want to continue having coffee with Dr. Cashy? Head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. It is very much appreciated. Thank you, and see you next week. Dr. Cashy is out.